BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio. Welcome to the 9th of September edition of Dialect Radio, from the heart of Bristol, in the subterranean vaults of No. 1 Mill Avenue, right by Queen Square. As another week starts, the students on their summer holidays are packing their bags and slowly heading towards Bristol, and the summer is slowly disappearing. Was it ever really here? Jerry Parker speaks to Tony Gosling about the early days of Radio Bristol. He was a racing correspondent for Radio Bristol. We also hear from Alex Dyson, who speaks to Anthony Page about solar cooking at the Western Green Fair, and we hear an extract from Public Money Private Gain, an ITV West investigation. First, the news from Tony Gosling.
And as the UK party conference season starts, Labour have been too embarrassed to be seen mixing with the weapons makers. But if Shadow Defence Secretary Liam Fox becomes a real minister, all that will change. Fox is timetabled to speak for the Defence Industries Council, an arms trade group led by BAE Systems Chief Executive Mike Turner. Fox shares the enthusiasm of the Vulcan wing of the US Republicans for military reaction to perceived threats, reflected in the title of another meeting he's addressing on resurgent threats, terror, Russia and Iran. The meeting is sponsored by yet another arms firm, EADS, who hope to sell loads of kit to a future Tory government. The Foreign Policy Centre think tank was founded by the late Robin Cook after Labour's 1997 election victory to further the ideals of his ethical foreign policy. But a decade on, at this year's Labour conference in Manchester, which starts on the 20th of September, the FPC is celebrating those ideals by organising meetings that look like the most naked lobbying for international big business. Development Minister Gillian Meron is talking about wealth creation, paving a way out of poverty, on an FPC platform funded by Coca-Cola, alongside Coke boss William Askew. Coke want to talk about their charitable work in Africa. They certainly don't want to talk about trade unionists being killed in bottling plants working for Coke in Colombia, or Coke plants causing droughts and misery in India. Environment Secretary Hilary Benn is talking about energy and climate change at an FPC meeting paid for by Swedish energy firm Vattenfall, which runs several nuclear plants in Europe and is considering buying ailing UK nuke firm British Energy. Will delegates hear how the head of Vattenfall Europe was forced to resign last year after a series of incidents in their German nuclear reactors, including a power station fire and plant close down? Internet gambling firm PartyGaming.com are paying for an FPC meeting with EU Commissioner Peter Mandelson and key Brownite Minister Shriti Vadera to discuss how governments and business should respond to renewed calls for protectionism in the EU. Energy Minister Malcolm Wicks will be talking about cutting carbon emissions on an FPC platform paid for by Rio Tinto, one of the world's leading coal mining firms. Last but not least, Lord Kinnock will be speaking about the credit crunch in a meeting funded by accountants KPMG. Would that be the same KPMG accused of fueling the crisis in the US when they passed audits of New Century Financial, a subprime mortgage lender, whose collapse helped spur the credit crunch? Indeed, it would. When a company hits tough times, the ad budget is always one of the first things to go. TV ad revenues in the UK are down 12% across all networks year on year, which suggests, as you'd expect in the current economic downturn, that many companies are short of a bob or two. Bucking the trend spectacularly, however, is the energy sector. Collectively, the Big Six, British Gas, EDF Energy, E.ON, N-Power, Scottish Power and Scottish and Southern Energy, have increased their marketing spend by 25% in the first 6 months of this year, coming at a time when gas prices for consumers have risen by 28%. You might wonder why, especially as the energy suppliers have been so keen to tell us the vast profits reaped on the back of rising oil prices are financing investment, not propaganda. EDF, for one, defended their increased marketing spend, saying energy had moved from being a commodity to being a brand. Unfortunately, for those unable to afford EDF's energy prices, a brand doesn't keep people warm. And finally, once again, dairy farmers are having to face the distressing task of shooting thousands of unsaleable black and white bull calves. At Sedgemoor Market in Somerset recently, 400 calves were on offer without a single buyer. All had to be shot. The trade has collapsed since the Dutch veal market closed its doors a month ago to British exports, following the discovery that a dozen calves exported to Holland from Worcestershire in May had developed signs of TB. It's yet another severe blow to Britain's dairy industry, since it's not long since the export trade in calves for veal was revived after years when exports to the continent were banned because of BSE. Every year, 500,000 Holstein bull calves are born in the UK as a byproduct of the dairy industry. Their mothers need to give birth to produce milk. The female calves can be kept to supply the next generation of dairy cows. But since British consumers lost their taste for veal, surplus male calves must be sold to those countries where veal is still prized. In the first 6 months of 2008, Britain exported more than 40,000 calves to the continent, more than half to Holland and Belgium. At this time of year, the trade would normally be near its peak, but after calves were found to be infected with TB in May, Dutch farmers insisted on a ban on further imports.
Thank you, Tony. Now for some music. This is Horse Box, and the tune is The Stupid Parts of Town.
dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now we're going to hear from Jerry Parker, who is former racing correspondent and employee of Radio Bristol. He speaks about the early days of Radio Bristol and his career, and this is part of the National Union of Journalists Oral History Project, as part of the website ontherecord.org.uk.
Well, my name's Jerry Parker, and I got started in the profession really by accident, and it's as simple as that. I'd always wanted to do some form of journalism, whether it be broadcasting or writing and so forth, But at school, nobody picked up the fact that I suffered from dyslexia. The next result was that I left school without passing any single exams. And in those days, if you didn't have a piece of paper to wave around to say that you could do things, then you couldn't do them. It was as simple as that. So I spent the best part of 20 years in business, reasonably successful, I suppose, which was a mixture of the fruit and veg business and in horse racing. And suddenly, because of a hobby, one night of amateur theatre, I met a man who was worked for the BBC, though I didn't realise it at the time. And he asked me to come up to visit him one day in Tindall's Park Road in what looked like a building site. And I thought he wanted some flowers, quite honestly, for his wife or somebody else. And he said, we're opening local radio here. And I said, when? He said, 10 days' time. And I laughed, because I thought, there's no way you were opening anything here in 10 days' time, quite honestly. And he said, we've been talking, you know, a great deal about horse racing. Would you care to talk to our sports editor and give him some contacts so that he can get information about horse racing? And I did. And after we'd been talking for a while, the sports editor said to me, well, I think that's too complicated. You wouldn't like to sort of take on the job of doing that for us. And so I took a voice test straight away and, very excited, went home to my wife to say that I was now the horse race correspondent of BBC Radio Bristol, which didn't mean very much, quite honestly. But the day it opened, we had a preview programme, and you've heard the expression of somebody going, literally going white before your face. And this is what happened to the sports editor, because we started the programme live, and he said to me, I went in while there was tape being played. We sat on a round table, and I had to do a 2-minute preview of Bath races. And he said, where's your script? And I said, pardon? And he said, where's your script? I said, I haven't got one. And he said, well, what have you got? And I had some notes written in the margin of Sporting Life. And here am I, never having broadcast in my life, in front of him, about to do a 2-minute preview without anything in front of me, which absolutely frightened him to death. But of course, I'd learnt it in my head. This is the only way I could do it, quite honestly, rather than sight read. And so that went off well. And that was the beginning of it, quite honestly. It was a wonderful time in Radio Bristol because you were starting from scratch. You had no lines to say you've got to work within this period or not. You made programmes, you had to be the producer, you had to be the presenter, you had to be the researcher, and it was a very thrilling and exciting time. You also only had a handful of listeners, so if you made a mistake, not many people heard you.
Yeah, I think that you probably agree there have been changes. Can you tell us about the way things used to work back when you very first started at Radio Bristol?
Well, I think there's been enormous changes. I mean, for instance, you know, you now have this playlist where you have music which is there and you have to play it off the playlist which is chosen for you. And they say it gives the actual station an identity because that's the style of music they're going to have. You chose all your own music. So if you were doing the afternoon show, as I did sometimes, and you had guests coming in, you chose the music that you thought would go with the guests. You chose the music that would go with your personality. And so the whole programme revolved around those two things. Now it doesn't. You've got to fit into this pattern that makes sure that when people switch on, this is the idea, I'm told, that they know it's Radio Bristol or it's whatever station they're listening to. Not so then. You could really let your own personality get involved in the show. I mean, all right, I'm old-fashioned in that sense. I think it's a pity, but nevertheless, it's that's where the big change came.
Do you think that there's any sort of professional aspect to that? I mean, as regards music and other things that producers have to deal with, do you think it's actually a professional issue or not?
I think it's a professional issue in the sense that I don't think the person who's actually now presenting or producing the show quite has the freedom that they once had. You know, you could go down more or less the lines that you were going. I know you had your boss above you listen to you and came in and told you, you know, you'd made a terrible error or so forth. But having said that, at least you had the initial chance to make your own feelings felt on the air. You could also do enormous difficulties like me. I got in terrible trouble once by presenting a record which should never have been played, called The Sun Has Got His Hat On. Now that sounds innocuous enough, doesn't it? And I played this and I sent to London with a copy of Henry Hall and the BBC Dance Orchestra playing The Sun Has Got His Hat On. Fine, and duly tried it for Level and played it. What I didn't know was that it was recorded in the early 1930s, and the original line in there is something which now is completely and utterly politically incorrect. The line being, you know, was he's been chasing niggers down in Timbuktu, which was hardly the thing to put on. I didn't realise it was there, quite honestly, and of course it's now part of the show Me and My Girl, and it's been changed, as you can imagine. I think it's he's been roasting peanuts down in Timbuktu nowadays. We had a lot of complaints, but not as many as you would think, and strangely, very, very few of them, in fact only, I think I'm right in saying, about three, from the black community. The majority of them came from other groups within the city who were very much more politically correct.
Okay, so you did a stint at Radio Bristol. How did that come to end, and then what did you subsequently do?
Before it came to an end, I started writing for the Western Daily Press. And that came about because the Western Daily Press weren't very keen to spend too much money on horse racing, information about horse racing, and the BBC Radio Bristol had no money. And what we had was that there was a wonderful man at the time who was a sports editor called Herbert Gillam. Herbie Gillam was a real old-fashioned journalist who'd come up, you know, learnt the job from carrying bits of copy around the office and so forth. And he ran a very good sports section in the Western Daily Press, but for his racing he kept telling me that he had nothing local coming his way, so there might be a meeting at Bath or Chepstow, and because his copy came down from the Press Association, they might be featuring York races, for argument's sake. So we were talking in those veins, but at the same time there were no mobile phones, remember, and so if you didn't have a landline and you were trying to report a football match, by this time, by the way, I was sports editor at Radio Bristol, you had a job, you had to hire somebody who had a line from the football ground. Herbie, of course, because he reported all the away games for the Western Daily Press, had this line. So we came to an agreement that I would do his racing and he would do my away football, and we wouldn't pay one another. And that's really how I drifted into, if you like, into the writing side of journalism.
What about the union? When did you first get involved with the union, and why?
To begin with, I'll be quite honest with you, self-preservation. I say that because when I started the BBC, one of the first people I worked with was a man called Don Moss. And Don had been one of the original disc jockeys on Radio Caroline. And we were talking one day, and then the manager as well, David Wayne, said to me, you know, we've got to have union members. As far as Radio Bristol were concerned at the time, they wanted people to be members of a union. And there were several unions one we could go into. I wasn't very keen on the broadcasting unions, and because I was interested in journalism as such, I discovered that as a presenter, I could join the National Union of Journalists. And so that originally, if you like, purely out of self-preservation is what I did. But having done so, I found it, you know, it was a very good thing to have that umbrella behind you. I think over the years, it's probably, it'd be fair to say that it had no longer, like a lot of unions, has the clout that it had in those days.
What clout did it have in those days?
Well, I think it had the clout that if there was any problem that you had behind you, you felt that you had somewhere with real strength that could come in behind you and say, I will support this person, and you could go to them, argue your case. I mean, not always. Sometimes your case didn't hold water, and naturally enough, they wouldn't support you. But in the majority of cases, they would. And to have the feeling that you had that sort of backup, and that nobody was going to walk all over you, as any big organisation like the BBC, or for that matter, the old Bristol United Press, as they were, that feel that you had that backing behind you gave you a great deal of strength, and gave you also the strength to say, well, I am going to go out on a limb and go down this line and make a big issue out of this, because you felt you had some backing behind you to do it.
What about the early days at the BBC here in Bristol and the union? Can you remember any disputes or incidents?
Yes, and not to my credit in some ways, if you like, because on one occasion I actually stopped BBC Radio Bristol supporting a strike at Radio Sheffield, I think it was. And it wasn't deliberately in a way, but there was not, I'll be confess with you, there was not a great interest in the union within the BBC. Most of them belonged to different unions, as I say, within the corporation. And there was a dispute over a man who'd been sacked at Radio Sheffield. I had heard about this from different people, and quite honestly, I couldn't find any reason why he shouldn't be sacked. That was a personal view, and the more I read it. But one night, the NUJ in Radio Bristol called a meeting, and we arrived and had our meeting. And at this stage, the majority said that we would walk out and support the meeting at the fellow at Sheffield. At which stage I pointed out that there were only actually three of us present. And since there were only three of us present, and I constituted a third of the meeting, that we couldn't really say that we would support him, because that wasn't a big enough majority. And that was unkind, wasn't it? But I thought, well, I'm entitled to stand my guns that way, just as I would in the opposite direction, quite honestly.
That was Jerry Parker speaking about the early days of Radio Bristol, and we're about to hear more in a moment, so don't go away. Now we're going to hear In a Matchbox from a local musician, Dave Green. That was In a Matchbox by Dave Green. If you want to know more, go to davidgreen.org.uk. And on the demo CD I have here, just to make it absolutely clear, what potential hirers will get is actually written, expect one man and guitar for gig. We're now going to hear more from Jerry Parker on the early days of Radio Bristol and his career as part of the NUJ Oral History Project.
Okay, so after your move into print journalism, what were the big differences and the changes that you found from doing broadcasting?
Well, the biggest change, I think, came into the fact that it wasn't so instant. I'd been used to, most of my time in broadcasting, I'd been doing live programmes, for instance. You know, you'd had a three-hour programme on a Saturday afternoon in which all the sports came in, and fronting that, you thought on your feet and so forth. Suddenly, you had the luxury, if you like, of being able to sit down and think out in greater detail what you were going to do. And there were two aspects of this at the same time. Not only the horse racing, which I had written that by that time for some 10 years, but also the theatre, which was my other great love, and which I had drifted into doing reviews and articles on different celebrities who came down here. But both of those things, you had that little extra luxury. I know not sometimes when you're up against a deadline, you haven't got a luxury, but those in the main were fewer than I'd been used to in broadcasting.
And what about union activity in the papers? Was there much when you first arrived, or what?
No, I arrived, if you like, towards the end of the great era in that sense. Around the period that I ceased to regularly broadcast, you were coming to the period when the union's power was beginning to wane within the paper. And so where at one time, if you said in 1970, for instance, when I first joined, they did have an enormous clout, I did feel by then that that was on the wane. Again, it was a pity because there were big changes taking place, serious changes taking place. Yet somehow or another, we had lost that great basis that we had earlier on, and it was needed at that time. I think a lot of changes took place in newspaper industry at that time, some of them necessary because television had eroded a lot of, you know, their previous the previous people who had been interested in newspapers. But nevertheless, we at an important period, we hit a low spot.
What about all the changes in technology as well? I mean, I imagine you've seen them and how it has affected deadlines and things like that. What do you make of all those changes? Because I think although it's fair to say, although there's a lot of the new technology has meant it's been positive in many ways, maybe it's been a step backwards in some as well. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, it seems strange to me. You see, I mean, I'm not a technical person. But having said that, it is wonderful. I mean, you know, the technology that we've got now at a fingertip is a completely different world. And it's a wonderful world, and it opens up so many opportunities. And yet deadlines, in many ways, have gone the opposite direction. I'll give you an example. I have done, for the last, well, nearly 30 years now, done racing selections for the Western Daily Press. Excuse me. And during that period, when I first started doing them, I would phone my selections in at night, and as long as I got them in by 7:30, that was fine. Nowadays, if they're past 4:30 at night, there's a scream down the phone as to say, where the hell are they? We need them. And with the modern technology, I sometimes blink and think, hey, man, hang on, you know, we used to sort of do this by hand, and I could do it 3 hours later, so what happened?
What do you put that down to? Because that is a bit mysterious, isn't it? Both for, I think, for journalists and the public, as to why it would be that with all this new technology, that that the deadlines have actually moved forward rather than back. I mean, of course, the other thing is that we used to have the stop press where reporters would wire in important copy or telephone it in very, very late at night while the presses were actually rolling.
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't know enough about the technical reasons for it, but I know that, you know, papers go to bed earlier than they used to, obviously. But why they should, when you've got all that technology, is it because, for instance, you know, so much more that the printers are now used to print more than just the paper? I mean, at one time, I mean, you know, the newspaper had its own print machine and that was it, and nothing else got printed on it. Perhaps it is that you're trying to get, you know, a quart in a pint pot, and by so you are pushing things, condensing things more and more. But I don't know enough about the technical side to really argue the point, quite honestly.
Okay, could you also tell us about some of the any sort of memorable incidents or memorable stories that you've covered during your career?
Well, one of the things I remember very strongly was the fact that I think I can claim to be the first journalist to be thrown out of Glastonbury. I went to the very first Glastonbury Festival, and in those days it was very strongly motivated politically, and CND, of course, was a very important part of it. And I'd been sent down and was asked particularly if I could get an interview with Arabella Churchill, who was Winston Churchill's granddaughter, who was very much involved with that original festival down there. And, of course, it was wonderful. You just parked in the village and walked through into the field. It was free, and there was nobody to stop you and so forth. And I made my way up to the house where they were organising everything, got in there and managed to get an interview with Arabella Churchill, and was going fine. But I then blotted my copybook by asking too many pertinent questions, I think, and two gentlemen decided that they...
Well, what sort of questions? Come on.
Well, I think mainly because I was trying to tie up the fact of what was Churchill's granddaughter doing, shouting the odds about CND and that side of politics. And it seemed to me that in many ways that she was very keen to be seen to be doing this, but when you tried to nail her down, I couldn't nail her down to actually telling me why she was doing it, or was it just natural rebellion against the previous generation? I don't know. But when I got onto that tack, that was enough, and I was escorted back to the farm gates and suggested that I left right away.
Fascinating. Okay, so anything else sort of more urban or something to do particularly with your fascinating career doing theatre reviews, maybe?
Well, the theatre reviews, the only thing I find there is that something that every journalist will have sympathy with, and is the fact that you send your copy in and you don't have the final say as to what it looks like when it gets onto the page. And over the years, there have been many occasions when I've read it and thought, hang about, I didn't write that, and that's not what I wanted to say about this. And I think it was one poor gentleman once that had the worst end of this. I went to see a production of Jesus Christ Superstar, and the fellow playing Jesus was desperately nervous, and you could see he was nervous, and he was terribly tense and uptight. After the interval, whether he had a few drinks or whether somebody talked to him, I don't know, but he relaxed and it was very different. So I said that he was very mechanical during the first half, but fortunately, and this wasn't meant as a pun, he got into the spirit of it in the second half and he relaxed and the whole thing was better. For some reason, the sub decided that I couldn't have that much room, cut it after the butt, and then put as a headline, Mechanical Christ, which said about the opposite of what I was saying about this poor man. And it's one of the few occasions when I actually spent the next couple of hours when I read it, finding where the director was so that he could go round and say to this lad, look, this is what he said about you, not this, and I apologise for it.
So how close does that sort of thing come to censorship, do you think?
I don't think it comes near censorship, because it's invariably done by a sub who hasn't got any agenda of his own. It's just he's in a hurry, or she's in a hurry, and they very often, unfortunately, whereas perhaps in the good days when there were lots more people in the newspaper, they pay often people who don't know theatre, are not interested in theatre, and so they merely wish to take out so many words, cut it down to a certain size, haven't got the luxury or don't want to give you the phone you up and ask you whether they can do it, but they will, not deliberately, I think, but they will by accident wind up changing the whole idea of what you've written there. And that, I mean, of course, that's annoying, but then you ask any journalist who's ever written a review that it ever happened to him, and of course it's happened to him over and over again.
There's lots of young people in the profession nowadays for all sorts of reasons. Often it's something as simple as that it's cheaper to employ young people. What advice have you got as someone that's been working in the business for a good many years for those youngsters on their first day on the newspaper or in the broadcasting, you know, doing journalism?
Well, one thing I'd say is something which at one time, you see, you had proofreaders, and they read things through, and so if the grammar was wrong, if the spelling was wrong, if the letter, they would correct it and so forth. You don't have those now, they go straight through. But for me, the whole thing is about communication, and communication goes back to language. We have a wonderful language in this country. I don't want people to still write, you know, airy-fairily and write as though they're doing a great discourse for a university degree. At the same time, I think if you've got to learn the nuts and bolts of what will come off the paper and attract somebody immediately. So you've got to have something, first of all, that grabs them. And for me, you've got to learn those nuts and bolts. So whether or not you are happy, you know, to use slang, expressions and so forth, fine. But remember, the person out there has got to immediately be able to pick up on what you've written, understand it, and then think, this is interesting, I want to read on from here. And if you haven't got those nuts and bolts, I don't think you're going to do that.
That was Jerry Parker talking as part of the NUJ Oral History Projects. And once again, for more information on that and more, ontherecord.org.uk. In a moment, we're going to hear from Alex Dyson about solar cooking at the Western Green Fair. But first, this is Mary Jane by Alanis Morissette from 1995.
What's the matter, Mary Jane? What a hard day. Is your place the don't disturb sign on the door? You lost your place in mine again. What a pity. Never seen no one to dance anymore. It's a long way down on this road.
That was Alanis Morissette from a very long time ago. Now Alex Dyson talks to our reporter Anthea Page from the Western Green Fair about solar cooking.
I'm at Weston-super-Mare and I'm at the Quarry Green Festival. And who am I talking to?
Alex Dyson.
And can you tell us what company you're from?
SolarSense. SolarSense UK.
And can you tell us a bit about this? It looks like a big silver satellite dish and there's a Africa connection there.
Yeah, what it is it's been manufactured principally inside Germany. It's basically a parabolic dish that converges the light's energy into a centre point. That heats up whatever's being cooked on there, and it was principally designed to get people in African countries to get away from using wood for fuel. The big problem with using wood for fuel is that it's not very healthy, and also it causes deforestation. In actual fact, wood smoke is the fourth biggest killer in Africa.
And how successful has this been?
It's been very successful. Personally, I haven't sort of followed it, but in Freiburg, for example, where there's been a lot of eco shows, they're very sort of pushing for it. The advantage of using such a system is it's so simple. You can any sort of reflective material, such as aluminium from even from some of the crisp packets, you can even sort of line shoe boxes and use that for cooking. So the great thing about the actual system is it's very cheap and very easy to make, which is ideal for countries in Africa.
So are there any villages in Africa using this at the moment, or is it just in its infancy?
I think at the moment it's just in its infancy, but it's also trying to sort of change the mindset of people in Africa, because there's the other sort of issue that you've got a person out cooking all day long in so blistering heat, so there is a potential sort of skin cancer. However, this can be overcome by using sort of suitable shelters and things like that, and it really is just sort of changing, educating people in the use of such a system.
So what about other countries like India?
Yep, anywhere that's got a good amount of sort of daylight or sunlight, even on a day like today, we're seeing sort of the kettle getting quite warm. And I have sort of had an occasion where the kettle did boil within 15 minutes.
We should explain there's a kettle in the middle of this dish, shouldn't we?
Yeah. So yeah,
it's
just
tripod,
it's just basically sort of sitting in the centre point of the dish, which is where the light all converges and converts into heat.
So the kettle is to demonstrate the kettle is actually being heated up by the rays of the sun striking the reflective material of the dish.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So if you did get the Africans to accept this, would it be an individual thing, like people would have it in their own house, or would it be collective village cooking?
I think it probably is like individual individual houses. It is simply because it's like the materials are just so cheap. Anything that is good and reflective, and then you can form it into a parabolic dish, is ideal.
So these could be made in big numbers?
Yep.
I mean, what would the average cost of each dish be? Have you got any figures?
The dish here today is around about £100, but that's been manufactured in a very sort of professional manner. But generally speaking, whatever sort of the materials are laying about on a reflective basis, we probably sort of do something for £5 along those lines, I would say.
In countries, they're very resourceful, aren't they? The way they adapt the wheel to every single need. So once they got the idea, they could do it for themselves, couldn't they?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, it's just showing them how to sort of build it, and then and away you go. So
would there be any way that people can access information about this?
Yeah, I think if you look on the web and just look for sort of solar cooking, there's a lot of sort of companies out there that are producing it. You could also go to sort of the Centre of Alternative Technology in Mahuncliffe. They'd probably be able to sort of point it the way. There's a lot of sort of solar books out there that would probably again give information about it.
Thank you very much.
Not at all.
In a moment, we're going to hear an extract from Public Money, Private Gain as part of the ITV West investigation. But thank you to Anthea Page, who spoke to Alex Dyson at the Western Green Fair.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now we go across to Jeff Sparks for the weekly What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 12th of September, and at the Croft in Bristol, Modi Lemon will be performing with support from Cappuccino or Catano. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Also on 12th of September, and this time at the Carlin Academy in Bristol, Meshuggah will be performing with support from Trigger the Bloodshed. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I'll feature a song titled Give Birth to a Smile, which is from the soundtrack to the documentary film The Body, which was released in 1970. Now this soundtrack was a collaboration between Roger Walters and Ron Geeson. This track, Give Birth to a Smile, features an uncredited appearance by all four members of Pink Floyd.
Long live the child and the man. Long live the mother and the land. The hills behind us and the sea. Reach out to welcome you and me. Valley deep and mountain tall. Lie upon the ground before us all. Strange are the colors of the turf.
Give Birth to a Smile from the soundtrack to the film The Body. Moving on to Saturday, 13th of September, and at Area 81 next to the Packhorse Pub in Lawrence Hill, Bristol, Super Gyration will be performing with support from Hellbound and Stalebreak. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door or £3 with a flyer. Also on 13th of September, and at the Kingswood Foundation, which is at 20 Old Schoolhouse in Britannia Road in Bristol, it's the Youth for Youth Festival. This year's lineup features headliners Roy World and other acts such as Studio Arcade, Neon Kicks, Misled Youth and The Fuel. Doors open at 1 p.m. and tickets are £3 in advance from Bristol Ticket Shop. On the day, the price is £3 before 6 p.m. and £5 after 6 p.m. Finally, I come to Sunday, 14th of September, and at the Carnation Tap in Bristol, three members of Flash Harry will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. That's all for me this week. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks, the one-man taxidermy revolution. You can now do a degree in Jeff Sparks at Dorking Polytechnic.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
This is now an extract from an ITV West investigation about public money and private gain.
Yes, John. This has been quite a controversial documentary, which has led to the police getting orders from the chief constable not to speak to ITV West. So if you've wondered why over the last month or so there's been not very many crime stories on the ITV West news, that's why. This documentary went out earlier in last month, that's in August, and it's a Somerset County Council and Avon and Somerset Police corruption scandal. And the only reason we can use the word corruption is because the Bridgewater MP, Ian Liddell Granger, used the word in the Houses of Parliament, and that means it comes under what's called parliamentary privilege. So it can then be broadcast that was what was said in the Houses of Parliament. Anyway, the plan is called Improving Services in Somerset, and it's all about a kind of private-public partnership or privatisation of the police civilian support services and many of the Somerset County Council civilian services, so civil servants working for the County Council. It's called Improving Services in Somerset, as I said, but who benefits from this privatisation and what are the actual improvements? Here, the Chief Executive of Somerset County Council, Alan Jones, and councillors come in for close questioning.
The ISIS vision was not without its critics.
We were getting more and more concerned because we thought there were other ways of improving services in Somerset than going into a joint venture company. And one of the options we were very keen on is in-house service improvement plans. But we felt at the time that they'd already made the mind up without any consultation.
No, we hadn't dismissed anything. What we were doing was looking at options. I mean, I was really attracted to the idea of a joint venture because of the reasons I've just given, that we simply didn't have those skills in-house.
We're all in favour of better efficiency and value for money in local authorities. No one would dispute that. But it's the way that we were going to go forward. And we had concerns that these type of joint venture companies allow the corporatisation and the big companies to get into local government. And once they're in, then, you know, what are you actually voting for?
So concerned was Unison that the union employed a consultant to examine ISIS.
There's a one in 10 chance that the project will fail. And there are other issues about, yes, you know, you can draw on the private sector advice and expertise. Nobody's against that. But the question is, how do you do that? And I would argue very strongly that that is best done by an in-house service. But Somerset, we're not interested in this. It's my strong view that, you know, the option of going down this route was decided before they ever wrote the outline business case.
We still had a very thorough exercise looking at the options before we finally, having consulted unions, staff, council members, partners and others, before we finalised on a joint venture.
Concerns were also expressed about the person hired to run the ISIS project.
Sue Barnes was a very effective director of resources in Suffolk, and Sue happens to be married to Colin Port, who is the chief constable of Avon and Somerset Constabulary. She came in to add additional weight, really, to make sure that the high-level contract discussions with the prospective bidders were going well. And she did a damn good job for us.
However, Susan Barnes's appointment was criticised in the Whitfield report. It concluded that, although there was no suggestion of any financial gain by Susan Barnes or her husband, there was a potential conflict of interest, a criticism also made in Parliament.
Her name is Sue Barnes. In fact, she's a constituent of mine. She also happens to be married to Mr. Colin Port, the Chief Constable of the Avon and Somerset Police. At best, this is an uncomfortable coincidence.
I'm absolutely certain it never became any kind of conflict of interest. You know, Sue is a very, very professional officer. She was not allowed into any detailed negotiations about the police and police numbers, and she wasn't allowed in any discussions between ourselves and the police about our own negotiation. If anybody wanted to hold up a red flag about this particular issue, they could have, and nobody did.
Susan Barnes, the Chief Constable's wife, would be paid over £200,000 during the last months she was running ISIS. But her salary wasn't the only controversial aspect of her appointment. Early last year, a critical stage had been reached, with three bidders all competing for the huge contract, BT, Capita and IBM. At this highly sensitive time, an event took place which, for legal reasons, we can't discuss.
There was a meeting. That meeting and the concerns that I'd have about that meeting are evidence before the Standards Board, and therefore I'm unfortunately not able to talk about it.
However, others feel less inhibited about discussing the impact the meeting had on the Council's then deputy leader, Paul Buchanan.
Last April, Alan Jones reported Councillor Paul Buchanan to the Standards Board. There were no less than 50, Mr Deputy Speaker, trumped up charges against that man. As a direct result, Jones silenced his most powerful internal critic. The Standards Board inexcusably, Mr Deputy Speaker, is still wading through them. This is a dreadful system that has permitted a brutal injustice.
How usual is it for a chief executive to make complaints, formal complaints, to the Standards Board for England about a member of, this, of an authority?
It's not very unusual at all. It's the chief executive's duty to be the last man or woman standing if complaints are made about a member.
You, I think, laid something like 6 dozen complaints against Councillor Buchanan. Most of
which... Where did that figure come from?
Most of which were rejected out of hand. The Standards Board looked at 11 of them, and you and Councillor Buchanan, I believe, were told at the beginning of this year that it was the Standards Board's view that he should be cleared of all the complaints.
Look, I'm not going to be drawn into a discussion about what the Standards Board have said, but let me tell you that, what you just told me is incorrect.
That verdict has never been published because you then promptly laid a whole load more complaints against him.
I can imagine where you got that information from, because there is at least one individual, I think there are at least two individuals, who are alleging that that's the case. That is false. I wrote the letter and I attached the evidence. The evidence was gathered from a large number of people who supplied it willingly.
Paul Buchanan declined to be interviewed for this programme, citing the continuing Standards Board inquiry. In a statement, he said,
"Unlike the Chief Executive Officer of Somerset County Council, I'm unable to comment on any aspect of the dozens of allegations he's made, as they're still under investigation. It's clearly unhelpful to the process and to natural justice to speculate or comment on any possible outcomes."
That's from Public Money, Private Gain, a West Eye View documentary last month. And you can view the full documentary at itv.com/west and click on the programmes on the right-hand side going to West Eye View, or you can find the film on Google Video.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show, come to you from Queen Square, right in the heart of Bristol. We had Tony Gosling and Anthea Page doing the reports this week, and thank you to Tony for the news. Jeff Sparks provided the What's On, and thank you to Jerry Parker and Alex Dyson for their contributions. I've been John Peters Coleman, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Meet us here again next week for more Bristol Dalek Radio. Feel free to email us, hearingbristol@gmx.com.